Vancouver, it's Seth. Here's a tip to make your transit ride even more awesome. I know your bag is probably very nice and you care deeply for it, but that doesn't mean it needs its own seat.
It is 83 days until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Canby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
And today we are joined by Tamara Baluja, the CBC Vancouver social media editor, the co-creator of the CBC Metro Matters email newsletter with Justin McElroy, friend of the pod, and the 2018 Michener Deakin Fellow for Journalism Education, once of the Globe and Mail, Province, CFRB, Toronto Star, and JSource. So, can you tell us a little bit about this newsletter that you've started?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me here on this podcast. That's fantastic. The newsletter really started off because I think both Justin and I wanted to do something about municipal elections. He and I worked together. As you know, he's the municipal affairs reporter for CBC Vancouver. And, you know, when he got that gig, he said, well, the elections are coming up. I want us to figure out what we can do. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking about lots of things, lots of other projects that I wanted to do. And one of them was trying out a newsletter for our station. And it just made perfect sense to try and do a focused newsletter on municipal elections. So that's how the idea really came about it. And when I pitched it to him, he was like, yes. He was like, I was thinking of the same thing as well. So we sort of both independently, but sort of together came up with the idea to do this. For us, it was both really important that we make a newsletter that wouldn't just appeal to people who follow this day in, day out, that it really would be a way to draw people in who maybe don't follow municipal elections all the time, but who want to make informed choices when it comes to voting time, you know?
People that aren't interested in a one-hour weekly podcast, for example.
Well, maybe. I mean, maybe, yeah.
I would bet there's a lot of overlap.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Yeah. I mean, we did say that the tagline for signing up for it is for political junkies and rookies. And so if you want to think about it that way, I guess Justin is the political junkie and I'm more of the rookie in this duo combo.
Because you're really recent to Vancouver, essentially.
Yes, I moved here 4 years ago, and I'm not a beat reporter. Like, mm-hmm. We do have many beat reporters in the newsroom. I'm not one of them. And so my job is really sort of diving in and parachuting in for whatever the main issue of the month is or the week is, and really helping the journalists in the newsroom get their content out in front of audiences and engaging with audiences. So between April and June last year, it was just all provincial politics,
right,
nonstop, like right from the debates all the way to when, you know, the government's actually switched over. And then, you know, the rest of the summer, it was all wildfires for me. So now it's switching gears. And for the next 83 days, I think you said, it's going to be municipal affairs, I think.
Well, and it was really funny because before we were recording, you were mentioning how, like, as new to, you know, only being in Vancouver for 4 years, you know, in your Toronto experience, they've got, you know, wild politics, but they don't have political parties. You get here and all of a sudden it's, what is this? And it's fascinating to me that that's the conversation that I have had with so many people that aren't from Metro Vancouver and then I got here and went, what is going on?
It really is different. And I think sometimes, you know, we forget that this is a city of immigrants and a lot of people who are not really, you know, have the baseline or the historical knowledge of what municipal affairs or provincial affairs or federal politics can look like in any given place that you have to vote. And so for me, it really is making sure that we do create a content that appeals to those people who are totally immersed in this kind of stuff. But if they are newcomers, like myself, relatively speaking, and this would be the first municipal election that will happen when I am actually living in Vancouver, for me. So, you know, it's about making sure that even those people feel comfortable making informed choices when it comes to voting time.
So you mentioned this junkie rookie pitch that you have for the newsletter. How do you make sure that the stuff that is for political junkies remains accessible to the rookies? Because at least for us, I know that is really, really easy to get off the...
Go into the wonky easily, deep end.
Yeah, yeah, to go into the weeds, to get a little deep into the...
jargon.
Yeah, jargon.
You know, that's a really good question. And I think, I think it helps that it's, you know, Justin and myself. So he has a lot of really great, deep encyclopedic knowledge for anyone who's met him. He can rattle off facts like nobody I've ever known. So, you know, he has that, but we're very committed to having a tone that is, I think when we were putting together the proposal, it was sort of like breezy, conversational, like, let's keep it real. And I'm actually sort of the filter for some of the stuff that comes in. And if I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about here, then you've lost your audience, you mm-hmm. know, because if you can't make it accessible to somebody like myself, who's university educated and who's interested, even if not super immersed in it, then it's not hitting the mark, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's how we're approaching it. And we try and CBC has this voice when we write our stories that is so formal, and it starts off with like, you know, like, here's the lead and here's the nut graph and da 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 da, here are all the facts. And when we try and summarize things in the newsletter, we're just like, let's get rid of all of that. What do you really need to know about this?
So you're able to go outside the typical CBC voice with the newsletter?
Style guide as well.
Yes. And that is something that we had to work out, whether or not, like, how far we could push
right.
that boundary. And it's only been two newsletters that have gone out so far, but I think at least we've hit the mark. And the audience really seems to be responding well to the tone as well. We've got lots of emails and tweets that have come our way that really talk about the fact that they appreciate that we're just not writing in a very sort of formal way right. and just being like, here's what you actually really need to know.
Yeah. And so your first edition was titled, Will Anyone Actually Care? Or something yes. like that. And there yeah. was a story behind that, right?
Yeah. So, well, Justin, we split off the writing duties between the two of us. And Justin always writes the big issue. And so I walked over to him on the day that we were writing it and said, okay, what are you covering in this section so that I can make sure that I'm not, mm-hmm. you know, rehashing the same thing in the sections that I'm writing. And he said, oh, the fact that it's, you know, 3 months to the election. I said, yes, I know. I mean, that's why we picked this as a launch date. And he's like, yeah. But like, you know, like what really happens and why are we launching it today? And like, even though everything is going to be shutting down in August, you know, there's still lots of stuff going on. So I was like, okay, so what you're telling me is that we're launching this newsletter and nobody's going to read it because none of this matters. Like, there's going to be no sessions. Why the heck are we doing this right now? And we just started laughing so much about it. And so we were just throwing off ideas. And I was kidding. And I said, I think our subject line should be, it's 3 months to the election. Does anyone care? And then he said, You do, because you were silly enough to sign up for this newsletter. And we were just laughing so hard about it. And then when it came time to actually write the newsletter, that was the only thing that came to mind. And we thought it set the tone up nicely for what people could expect as well. So that's what we went with.
Yeah, it's really neat. I think all three of us have signed up for it.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely put a link for it in the show notes. But do you want to let listeners know where they can find it?
Yes. People can subscribe to it by going to cbc.ca/metromatters.
Okay. Super easy.
So you do a couple other things besides the newsletter. You've told me when we were speaking over the phone that you spend a lot of time on social media, but professionally, as it were, sort of monitoring the engagement with CBC stuff. You're talking about how people have been emailing, you know, both for the newsletter and just generally, I think, about the coverage and following like Facebook conversations and things like that. Not in a creepy way, but I guess I'm just kind of curious, like, what is your overall broad take on what the discourse, as it were, is in Vancouver politics on social media?
That's a very broad question.
Sure.
So I think what I've noticed is that there are different conversations happening on Twitter than what are happening on Facebook. Twitter seems to be, you know, if I was to break it down for the newsletter again, you know.
Angry? Is angry the word?
Angry, but like more partisan and, right. you know, more for political junkies.
Yep.
And it seems like there are a lot of people talking at each other instead of with each other. So that's what I see happening with the Van Poly hashtag, for example. Mm-hmm. On Facebook, it seems to be slightly different. We have this Facebook group that CBC Vancouver launched back in May for housing affordability. And in that one, you know, the conversations seem to be, I think there are very few actually politicians on that in that group. It mostly is just people who are affected by it. Mm-hmm. And in that, I think, you know, there is sort of this sense of like, no matter what happens with these municipal elections, there's not going to be anything really that comes out of it that's going to create a positive solution for the housing affordability issues in the city. And I think, you know, that's sort of the interesting dynamic that I'm seeing between those two platforms. And as for my job, you know, kind of creeping on it, I mean, yeah, I do have to. Because, yeah.
Well, yeah. It makes sense that the major news outlets would try to figure out what the general consensus in the city is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm actually a little surprised by that, although there seems to be a lot of interest in covering issues of housing affordability, I don't know, I kind of feel like there's a little bit of a fatigue.
Okay.
I don't know quite how to articulate it or why I'm sensing that, but it just seems like there is like a sense of like, this isn't going to get fixed, you know?
That pessimism is very interesting, because I think you see with some of the political parties, especially the more fringe ones, perhaps, in what I'll call them, and I'm not putting words in your mouth for sure, but like the pro-Vancouvers and the some of the trolls almost on Twitter who are very like angry, but they don't seem to have alternate solutions. And so they're just like focused on developers are greedy and their city politicians are corrupt and nothing's going to change. So
I feel like those people, those people have been saying that for every election that has ever happened, though. I feel like the sort of the Facebook comments that say, you know, well, this will never happen because the city's full of corrupt people or the city councilors are taking bribes or all those other things that are not. They're demonstrably not true. I think that we've always had that sort of that cantankerous wing of our electorate that posts on Facebook these things. I don't know if there's any more of it this year than there would be in any other year.
I hate those people.
I mean, yeah.
It just ruins everything and doesn't do anything to like build up a civic society or civic sphere. One thing that, you know, I've learned over many, many years of being involved in politics, but, you know, particularly with respect to this election, is that most of the people, if not all of the people who have decided to put their name down on a ballot are doing it for the right reasons. And I may disagree with them on, like, somewhere between, you know, 50 and all of their ideas, 50% and all of their ideas, but, like, they're still honestly expressing those ideas and trying to make a better city.
Spinning off that, though, one of the things I was wondering if you've seen is, you mentioned politicians don't tend to be on the Facebook groups, or at least the ones you're looking at. Do you think, though, there's value to politicians engaging with people either on Twitter or in these Facebook groups? And have you seen that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think as much as media organizations want to be there to make sure that, you know, we are the conduit between the public and these people who have a message, the reality is that, you know, things like with social media, you can break that wall down. And I think this is a little bit like media focused, but, you know, it's up to us as journalists to figure out how we can make sure that we're still part of that. So last year, when the provincial elections were going on, we actually invited all three leaders to do Facebook Lives with our audience. And in the end, Christy Clark dropped out, and so we only got two of them. But we had basically, I think it was like either almost 45 minutes to an hour with both Andrew Weaver and John Horgan taking questions directly from the audience. And all our journalist was doing was taking those questions and asking them to the leader straight from the Facebook feed. And I was literally feeding them to the journalist, to Richard Sussman right away, and saying, this question just came in 30 seconds ago. And, you know, that was just amazing, because I think people really felt engaged in being able to ask politicians directly what they wanted to ask them. And I think that there's tremendous value in that, and we shouldn't discount the value of being able to engage with your audience on social media.
So two questions on that. One, what was the general, like, for lack of a better word, quality of the questions that were coming in? And then, were there any questions that the general public was asking that you don't think a reporter would have thought to have asked?
The quality of the questions varied, I would say. I mean, you got the whole spectrum from not even questions, but more comments saying, you're not going to fix anything. Why are you here? You know.
Right. Why are you so terrible and dedicated to ruining the province?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and so you had those, and it was my job to make sure that those didn't make it to Richard when he was asking the questions to the politicians. But there were actually really smart questions. And I think it's not so much that the journalists wouldn't think of asking those questions or the media wouldn't think of asking those questions, but it's the fact that there is this direct connection between the audience and the politician. And I think if we as the CBC can do something to facilitate those conversations, and that's a huge part of my job, is to make sure that people are actually engaging with each other as opposed to, as I said before, just like talking at each other, then that to me is a great way of ensuring that the CBC has a role in promoting civic engagement, right? And so that to me is really what that was about. But it was also interesting to see how there were certain questions which I wasn't, you know, like it felt like the media wasn't necessarily thinking about them as being major issues, but it was really important to this one guy who really wanted to know, for example, what would happen to certain arts funding. I don't know if we would have ever asked that question at a scrum. This guy got a chance to ask the question to both the politicians, right? And so there is value in that, I think.
Well, it's been interesting. I found with this podcast, the politicians are so approachable, and like we've had no problem really getting Hector Bremner or John Cooper.
Really, anybody.
And like I know people.
We interviewed Sean Sylvester and Kennedy Stewart as well. And, you know, just everyone's interested.
Ken Sim could give us a call back, but, you know.
Almost everyone.
Yeah. And I think what we have to try and figure out is how we're going to have those conversations, you know, about like for civic engagement on CBC, because it's not like there are three parties with three leaders. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot more varied, and we've got to figure out how we're going to do it. So that's my next challenge. Yeah.
So more broadly than just the social media conversation, what are you sort of hoping to see going into this election, maybe from a professional lens? Like, what are the kind of things you're hoping to cover, or where do you hope this newsletter goes? I know I'm asking in a broad way, but maybe you can take a question however you want.
Well, I'm hoping for lots and lots of subscribers. that is sort of the baseline on a very crude level.
We sympathize. I basically evaluate my worth as a human being by the number of downloads in each episode gets.
I go by Patreon dollars.
I'm really glad that Google Chrome won't tell me how often I reload our download statistics.
Yep, and for me, I've sort of become a little obsessy over the open rate and click rate on the newsletters. Yep. There was literally at one point the day after we launched, and it was the weekend, and I was literally sending Justin like Saturday obsession report. I'm texting you the details. Sunday obsession report, Monday obsession report. Yeah. Anyway, lots of subscribers. But aside from that, what I'm really hoping is that the audience actually sends us questions that they want answered, and that we will try and get them answered. Whatever it is, you know, whatever question you have that will help you make a decision when it comes to how you want to put, you know, a tick on the ballot, I want to be able to be that newsletter to be that space where they can get those answers. And, you know, it could be something as simple as this one person messaged us on Facebook and said, well, where can I find out all the latest financial reports from the city of Vancouver? And, you know, what is the status of our debt? And it was like, okay, great. If that will help you decide how you want to vote, then great.
The easiest information request.
Exactly. It honestly took me like 30 seconds to Google that, but it was like, okay, if we as a CBC can help you do that, I will do that. And so I'm hoping that whatever questions they have, they will send us and that we can get that going.
Yeah, I think that it's an undervalued concept is the idea. And I deal with this at work as a policy researcher, is that I'm professionally trained at how to Google, you know, in a sense. You know, journalists are professionally trained at how to find information and obtain that information. And like your average citizen isn't necessarily. And so your average citizen isn't going to be able to find the financial reports from the city of Vancouver very easily. Whereas, you know, I pull up the TransLink financial reports because I happen to be watching the live feed of their meeting last week. Like, this is something that I just do, and that's something that a journalist can do. And that's, I think, the real value add there, is that ability to get that information out there that an average citizen would find too hard to find.
And I think it's more than just getting the information, because if someone truly wanted to Google it, they could Google it, but to then be able to make sense of it. So yep. I think that's the sort of extra step that, you know, at least journalists can do, which is like, here's all of these reports. What's the one fact you actually need to know? Yep. Right. And to distill that information down in a way that is accessible and doesn't seem like you're reading an Excel spreadsheet. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's really, I think, where we can make it more accessible for the average voter.
People have questions or comments to get to the newsletter. What are the best ways for them to get in touch with it?
Tweet me or tweet Justin or email us at metromatters@cbc.ca.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I wanted to get your take on like your broad impressions of the race as we, you know, kind of dive into the news of the week. What do you think of the race so far in Vancouver specifically?
Justin and I were actually talking about it where I think, you know, there might be value in saying, okay, here are basically like the rough senses of what the platforms will look like. And we'll probably do Vancouver at the very end. So I'm going to reserve maybe answering that question down the line.
I believe that was just a kind of backhanded commitment to come back on the pod at some point. So,
hey, if you want me, sure, make that work.
You know, and in your defense, the parties don't really know where they stand on half of the issues anyway. So,
but one of them now has candidates.
One of them does now have candidates. Them. Yes, they do. Yes, Vancouver has their slate after their recent candidate selection meeting, which happened, I believe, yesterday.
Yesterday afternoon.
Yes, at the Polish Community Center on Fraser.
Which is entertaining because that's also where one city had their nomination vote for city councillors. So clearly the Polish Community Center is nonpartisan in every possible way.
Except for being the nonpartisan association, of course. Nonpartisan except in the nonpartisan sense.
And an affordable venue.
Yeah, it's an affordable and easy to get to venue is, I think, the key part.
But I think what was interesting coming out of this decision yesterday is it didn't end up being a vote, and the people who did end up winning or getting acclaimed were kind of a surprise to everyone except maybe like the handful in the room.
Yeah, it really had the feel of that style of, not necessarily the way the NPA has done things, but the way a lot of political parties do things, where they put together their recommended slate, like what the Green Party did, and then they put it to the membership, is what this really felt like. Because, you know, obviously these people were all fairly handpicked. Obviously these people were, you know, the party executive pulled them together and then put them to the membership. And then, you know, there's some trappings of democracy here, but it really seems to have been a handpicked group, which is not, I will say, not necessarily a bad way to go about forming your slate.
Although there have been a number of names that we've talked about in the past. Indeed. Adrian Crook, my co-host on Politico, Scott DeLangeboom, Wade Grant from the Musqueam Nation had all been talked about as being seeking this.
Yeah, and we had especially thought Wade Grant because Wade's brother is on the board. And so because Wade had been rumored already and his brother was put onto the board, it was sort of assumed that this was a precursor movement. But it is interesting that basically none of the people that were involved in Hector's sort of take over the NPA bid are running for them again. Now, we know that Adrian Crook is going to run it as an independent. Reached out to him and he said that, you know, honestly, it really just came down to having a bad feeling about running for the NPA, about that NPA process and wanting to stay out of party politics. And maybe this is the year of the independent. There are a number of high-profile independents that
it's not.
Could, well, I know, but you never know.
We could have a majority independent council.
But it is, I think it's certainly eyebrow-raising to see all of these people that were sort of the core of the group not be part of the core of the group going forward.
Well, and Scott cited personal reasons in his decision not to seek it, and asked him about that, and he's still involved.
Yeah, he said he's still very much supporting Yes Vancouver, so it's not like he's been sort of kicked to the curb in that way. Yeah, I will say it is a impressively diverse group. It's a gender-balanced group. It's a group with a lot of voices from a lot of different places, almost like Mark Morrison knew what he was doing and found people from all sorts of communities, which is not a bad thing in politics.
So, I have to say that I am very impressed with the deftness with which Mark was able to maneuver not only a, you know, temporary ad hoc rainbow coalition, but also do it in such a way that there weren't a ton of hurt feelings by people who could have taken their groups of supporters and gone home, which is a hazard in municipal politics. But because we should make a point of doing this. The Yes Vancouver slate for City Council is Phyllis Tang, a researcher at UBC Access and Diversity, Glynis Chan, the president of Happy Times Travel and Tour, Stephanie Osler, who owns Devil May Wear Boutiques, Berinder Baines, who owns the Cobb's Bread franchises.
No, owns three Cobb's Bread franchises.
Yep.
And sits on the West End Business Improvement Association.
And Jaspreet Virdi, a pharmacist and volunteer.
But the interesting thing here, like it, as you've alluded to or said, Patrick, it's a diverse and multifaceted. It's a group that represents a lot of different ethnic communities, gender balanced. Mm-hmm. Once you add in the School Board and Park Board, it's actually majority women for a council, mm-hmm. Small business owners, people with nonprofit experience. But as far as I can tell, none have political experience.
No, but I mean, when you think about it, you know, does Brandon Yan and Christine Boyle, do they have political experience for one city?
And Stephanie Osler gave that TED talk and has been, like, she's been a public figure.
The thing is that the point that I was sort of trying to get to is that, you know, municipal elections aren't necessarily where people arrive with pre-existing political experience.
It's where they get it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, even Michael Wiebe, who's going for council now, I mean, one term on Parks Board. You know, that's that does not a politician one make necessarily.
But I mean, you can have political experience beyond, you know, electoral politics. Right. And I think Christine Boyle comes out of a lot of
elected positions and a lot of sort of positions of leadership within the church community. Yeah, and that's an example. I think you could come up with it for example, right? Yeah, no, fair point. But it, you know, but this is a right of center party. Owning a business to a right of center party is the same as being the board
executive director or board member
or a board member of a nonprofit that helps the homeless.
And each of these candidates did have to get 50 names supporting them who are Yes Vancouver members, meaning they had to sign 50 people up for Yes Vancouver, and they had to get $5,500 in donations, which you can't just get one check from anymore. That's five checks at least.
Yeah, but I mean, I think really those are very low bars. Those are very normal bars, I think, for a nomination. It's very normal that you have to sign up oftentimes more than 50 people. Mm-hmm. The $5,500 mark, we can't benchmark that against other parties very easily because this is the first election with the electoral reform on financing. And so it's hard to say. I can tell you that Vision Vancouver traditionally, for incumbents, when they wanted to run for re-election, and in order to protect their incumbency, they were required to raise $15,000. This year, Vision dropped that down to $7,500, so that Heather Deal only had to raise $7,500. So, like, $5,500 is a reasonable amount for a party to ask for from a candidate. You know, one of the jobs as a candidate is to raise money for the party.
And it's not like, you know, these people have not been involved in their various public spheres of Business Improvement Association.
BIA is a really good background.
Gurren and Nanak's Free Kitchen,
is an amazing program.
Yes, and I can attest to the quality of their food because they gave out free plates at Visaki, mm-hmm. Which is right by my house.
And that's Jaspreet Virdi, who's volunteered with them.
Mm-hmm.
We should mention Yes Vancouver also nominated a school board candidate in Jorge Julian Prieto, who we've maybe mentioned before. I know he was seeking, mm-hmm. rumored to be seeking the nomination, and Leo Heba for Park Board, and he had announced he was seeking that a little while ago, and I couldn't find much about him.
No,
I
wonder why. Only one for each?
Yeah, one for each.
I almost wonder why they bothered at all. You know, as a new party, you're going to be really limited with how much you can really fight and get a message out, and trying to get three different messages out is going to be harder.
What is the Let's Fix Housing message on Park Board?
Or what's the Let's Fix Housing message on school board?
Bulldoze Langara Golf Course and turn it into, like, a massive arcology.
Or it's just yes.
Oh, Justin McElroy is going to not like this episode.
He was the one who wrote that article.
I know, and he was very conflicted writing it.
Well, Charlie,
he, in fact, I think was at the Langara Golf Course today. I think I saw a tweet about it.
So Charlie Smith's argument in the Georgia Strait for why you would run just one school board and one park board is you actually have somewhat of a chance of getting in there. In both cases, people are looking to fill out a slate, and if you are just one extra name to add on, you might get a lot of, I'll vote Green, I'll vote MPA, I'll take off the yes, and they might just get a toehold.
Yeah, people like to, there are a lot of voters that like to spread their ballot out, mm-hmm. regardless of the fact that the math on the way the electoral system works makes that a weird choice. That also is true. And it also, you know, it's another foot soldier that you have. It's another person that you have that's going to raise money, that's going to go door to door, that's going to do the hard work that a candidate will do. And that may bump your council candidates by, you know, 100 or 200 votes or more.
But otherwise, I learned from Francis Beulah's Twitter and some of the other conversation, there was about 100 people in the room.
Yeah,
and this was both, well, celebrated by Let's Fix Vancouver crowd and condemned by people who hate them.
Well, I mean, one city had, I think, about 500 or 400 people vote in their leader, in their nomination race.
And the NPA had 3,000 votes, I think.
Something like that. Yeah. One city being like this small niche party in Vancouver. And so now when I'm comparing them unfavorably in terms of their turnout to the small niche party, that is a good question.
Well, and I think NPA had about 100 people in the room for the actual speeches is what I vaguely recall.
Yeah. And I think one city had about 100 people for their speeches as well. Vision, I think more, but Vision is a bit of a machine.
So it's not awful.
Yeah, no, I think it was a solid. The photos I saw seemed like a solid turnout. Yeah.
Well, the next station, please. Translink FERC changes have come to Vancouver. Patrick, you have some information for us on the Mayor's Council.
Yeah, so I happened to watch the live feed of the Mayor's Council meeting and while I was doing my work.
How do you happen to do that? It seems like something you have to go out of your way to do.
I discovered Periscope.
Well, and also the day before, I happened to load up the City of Vancouver council debate on the View Corridor. So, like,
which we'll get to.
There's a lot of me watching live feeds of minor governmental actions last week.
That one is fair, actually.
I want to say hopefully your bosses aren't listening, but your job is policy research, so you can kind of justify it, maybe?
Yeah. For one of them, I was actually home. I was at home that day. But so for the TransLink fare changes, I happened to be at home, and TransLink had their regular meeting with the mayor's council, and there was a lot to unpack that they talked about. They had the big announcement that I think we had a bit of a clip of in our intro. Which was obviously Seth Rogen's involvement in the transportation system of Metro Vancouver. They also had a whole host of other things that were brought up. But the biggest key thing was that they finalized the report on the distance-based fare changes that the Metro Vancouver is undertaking. And the first preface I would put to this is I don't actually think this is a real change.
Just to break it down, though, right now Vancouver has zones. We have...
Yeah, we've had system since TransLink was created in 1999. And in fact, I think the zone system actually predated TransLink and it was a BC Transit creature. And the zones essentially are the Fraser River breaks away zone 3, but the Northeast is part of zone 3 for reasons that are are due to population densities of 1990. And so that's like Coquitlam and whatnot. Zone 2 is Burnaby, New Westminster, as well as Richmond. And then Zone 1 is Vancouver. Zone 2 is also North Vancouver, weirdly enough, which enables an increase in fare for the C bus. And so what's effectively happening is that the buses currently don't operate on the zone system because we don't have tap out. Although TransLink has been very careful on all of their messaging to say that we don't have tap out yet. And so at some point, TransLink could decide to implement a tap out system where you have to tap out.
They're going to have to figure out how to do it, though, because I remember them having massive problems getting that actual, like...
It's a culture problem rather than anything else. And other cities that have had dealt with the culture problem of ensuring that riders remember to do it
There was an actual technical problem with
this. No, it was entirely people, as far as I could tell, because it's the same technical issue stuff as London's.
No. Other cities have had those problems, and what they do is they have an automatic audio recording at every bus stop saying, remember to tap out.
And that could be Seth Rogen now.
Anyway, so the buses will stay the same. C-Bus and the SkyTrain system will be moved on to a distance-based fare system. Now, the zone system was always meant to approximate a distance-based fare system. So that if you're traveling from Surrey to Vancouver, which is a very long distance, and you're using significantly more and much more time on the system than somebody that's traveling from, say, Newton to Guildford inside of Surrey, you would pay more. And that made sense. Similar to, if you're driving from Surrey to downtown Vancouver, you're going to pay more in the long run in gas and wear and tear. And so this sort of approximation of distance has now been eliminated. And because it created all sorts of warped situations. So an example that we were talking about before the podcast was, what about that person that lives at Gateway SkyTrain Station and works in New Westminster? That is two SkyTrain stops. That is not very far. What about the person, that works at the Starbucks in Metrotown and happens to live at Joyce SkyTrain Station in one of the sort of fairly large-scale developments there? That's two SkyTrain stops. And Patterson's really not much of a stop. And so those people are paying additional zones despite the fact that they're only going a kilometer and a half to 4 kilometers or what have you. And so that distortion is being gotten rid of by a kilometer-based system. The one caveat that TransLink said was that people that were paying at a three-zone rate will not pay more than they currently pay. And so some people will be paying less. Like if you're those examples that I was saying, some people will be paying more if you are, for example, going a very long two-zone distance. You would be paying closer to the three-zone rate than you would be paying the two-zone rate, for example.
And to be clear, like the system right now is a distance-based system. It just uses like...
It's an approximation of.
It just uses a very like
crude.
Large. Yeah, it's a very large.
It's it's meant to attempt. It's meant to attempt to capture it.
Yeah,
and we could never move to a true distance based system under the previous honor system. But now that we have the tap in tap out on the SkyTrain and CBUS, you have that system.
And, well, the other way I even thought of it is the zones just become relative to where you are. So if you get on at Metrotown, the next two stations are zone one. Stations after that. Or zone two, and then...
The other key thing here is that the CBUS is going to become a lot more affordable because it's distance-based. The CBUS actually costs a lot per kilometer to operate, but let's ignore that for a second. The CBUS only runs like a 2-kilometer span, and so the distance there is going to be very low. So if you're a commuter, and we saw this when the fare gates came in and the all-zone bus riding existed, people started to transfer to buses that went over one of the two bridges on the North Shore to Vancouver or vice versa, and avoided the CBUS. And so what you'll see is people will go back to the CBUS, which is really where the system is geared towards, and this will make for a more efficient system there, which is a value add.
So I asked this as somebody who mostly bikes around everywhere and doesn't takes a...
All of us are cyclists here. That's awesome.
Very, very rarely I will get on the transit system. So is there any clarity on what will happen if you're only going like one stop? Like, do we have a sense of what the baseline fare is going to be?
My understanding of it was that it would be a small base fare for the first like 5 kilometers or so.
And yeah, that's my recollection. But it's a really good question. I wish I had the answer for you up in front of me.
I vaguely felt like I read this somewhere, but I just want to...
Yeah,
I feel like it won't be 25 cents.
Yeah.
The Vancouver Sun had a slide from TransLink and... kind of showed the rough approximations. Most of the fares were minor
changes. I believe that that there won't be a decrease in the current base fare. So like that $2.35 rate, I believe will still continue to be the minimum, and then that five whatever it is for a three zone will still continue to be the maximum, is my understanding of it. But yeah, it's a really neat thing. The other thing that TransLink is going to look to do is to introduce daytime non-rush hour pricing. So right now that rush hour pricing is where that zone or distance comes in. So daytime will go back to the way it was about 20 years ago to having no rush hour pricing, and early morning will not have rush hour pricing. The cool thing that that does is that'll see significant shift in transportation user behavior. And we know this because before we abolished that system, we had a much more balanced load time in terms of our peak usage through the day. And so what that meant was that the peaks of morning and afternoon commutes were much lower, and the people were shifting their times to get to work a little earlier and leave work a little earlier so they could pay half the price. And that was a real value to TransLink because it meant that they didn't have to like really juice the system for that 1 hour of max peoples. And that this is going to, while it'll cost TransLink money, it's actually it's an efficiency saver. And I'm really looking forward to them bringing that in.
Can I just make one like quick point as somebody who's not a native Vancouverite? I'm so confused why the Canada Line is already at maximum capacity. Like, it just like blows my mind.
Because the BC government didn't believe it would work and they wanted to underbuild it so it would be on budget.
No, I mean, I know the reasons, but it still blows my mind.
It's amazing to me that they massively overbuilt the Portman Bridge and massively underbuilt the Canada Line because of, I think, a belief that roads, people drive, and people don't like transit.
I mean, we do have indicators that induced demand would have made the Portman full, but that is bizarrely not happening.
The Canada Line is expandable, though, as far as I remember.
They installed all the stations with knockdown walls so that you could expand it, but obviously it's going to cost a lot more to do that after you've built the stations than if you'd just done it in the first place.
And they also have dugouts for a couple possible extra stations, which would, again, still take more.
That's at 33rd and 57th in Vancouver.
For when they
need to do a whole Vancouver auto on the Canada Line one of these days.
I'm a giant transit nerd. I don't know if anybody's noticed that.
And to be clear, the change to the fare structure is only for SkyTrain and Canada Line.
And CBUS.
And CBUS.
Yeah, so it's all the rail lines.
Non-bus.
It's the non-bus. Yeah.
So presumably the gondola will also be included. if it ever gets built.
It was interesting to see the audience reaction to the announcement when it came. There were definitely people who said that this would make them ride transit more. And then there were other people who were just like, no, no, no. Like, this is not the way to go. And I tried to engage and I was like, well, what would you suggest as an alternative proposal? And no one really had any alternative ideas. But it was sort of like a lot of people felt in our comments that this would actually change whether or not they would get on transit or leave their car behind.
That's really interesting. And I think it's also indicative is, you know, I was very involved in the transit referendum and people hated Translink. But I really think the way in which people love this Seth Rogen stuff and that are adopting and are saying things like this about Translink, like I really think Translink has really shifted its public opinion. And you might see this in the social media trends.
Oh, I mean, with Seth Rogen there's like a huge coup for them, right? Like, come
on. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it's better than Morgan Freeman and then having that on the day of. Be canceled because of Me Too allegations.
But the just to finish up, there was a couple other things, was that 5.8% increase in year-to-date journeys on the transit system, which is a huge bump. North America-wide, we're seeing decreases in ridership in almost every city except for essentially Seattle and Vancouver. And it's really fascinating. That's a huge, huge good news story for TransLink. They did an update on some of their Beeline work. That's not a lot of new story, but they're bringing in 4 new Beelines next year, which is going to be really good. And then 3 more 2 years from now. A couple of quick hits here. Ken Desmond also really hit on it. I thought this was fascinating, as he said that they try to do a really good job of building transit in a way that people want to ride it. But he gave a lot of props, partly because his audience was the mayor's council, to the region for building transit-oriented development. And he talked about right now there's 50,000 developments either in process, under construction, or under application, 50,000 units of housing going in along SkyTrain routes. And that means, you know, another 50,000 riders or more. And so
minus all the people being dem evicted in Burnaby.
Yes. But I mean, the map did show it being around the whole region. It's not all the dem evictions. But yeah, those were a couple of really interesting things. This is a really good time, I think, for TransLink. And there, it seems like ridership growth is going to continue because transit service is going to keep growing.
And well, ridership growth means unexpected revenues, which
potentially, we'll have to hopefully. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with that.
Well, from one Crown Corporation to another, the Pavilion Corporation, or PAVCO, as it is
lovingly known. Oh, I didn't even know it was stood for Pavilion Corporation. That makes sense and is really dumb.
You hate all names. I think you just don't like proper nouns. That's my charge against you this week.
I'm not good at capitalization.
Well, that would explain it. Anyway, view cones. The city has approved a 400-foot tower that partially blocks the North Shore mountain views in one of Vancouver's view cones. Well, why don't we back up for a second and figure out what a view cone is?
So the city has, I think there's 20-something view cones that are designated. The view cone program came out of the 80s and 90s. It was a very large public stakeholder relations operation where the city took in a whole pile of opinions and views and decided that...
Shape them into a cone with nori and rice.
I believe it was under the Harcourt mayor, LC. And one of the things they decided was that from a number of public places and iconic locations in Vancouver, you should always be able to see the mountains. You should always be able to see, or like the points of the mountains from those locations that are, you know, theoretically iconic. So that when you're, and this is the view cone in question, you should be able to see the mountains from 12th and Cambie.
The mayor's office. The mayor should see the mountains.
The mayor's office is, I believe, its own separate view cone.
Oh, right.
The mayor's office window has actually, and I'm not joking, I believe its own view cone. And the view cones are something that I actually really support. I know that there's some criticism of them here and there, but the idea of them is to ensure that from a number of public locations, there's criticisms here that all of them but two are located in the west side and so on and so forth. But like, you know, Queen Elizabeth Park, the top of Queen Elizabeth Park has a view cone that is protected so that you can see the mountains from the top of that park.
And I think that's a hard one to intrude on, though.
Yeah, because you're high.
I mean, it's the highest point in the city, right?
Yeah,
but, you know, if I get my arcology, then, you know, I have to make sure it fits into the view, except Glengarry Golf Courses and stuff. But
anyway, so there's a lot of conversation to be had here. But we have pierced the view cones twice before. I believe it's One Wall Center. It will be piercing the view cones. It's under construction. Trump Tower pierces the view cones. And famously, the Shangri-La was the first building to really pierce the view cones. We have done this in different places. But this one was obviously a controversy. Was Pavco wants to build a 400-foot building that would be all condos located in the way of a view cone from Canby and 12th.
Well, did they actually want to build a 400-foot? Because I read some unclear. Things. It wasn't even really clear what they were applying. I think they were applying for 300, and the city said, well, what if you built up to 400?
I thought the Shangri-La... Just sort of stepping back for a second. I thought the Shangri-La broke the height restriction and not the view cone itself.
I think you might be right, yeah, because the Shangri-La doesn't break the view cone protecting a certain view of the lions, but it kind of still does.
At any rate, view cones, like, I believe they started in London, where there was a...
Oh, okay.
You had to be able to see St. Paul's Cathedral from a point in a park somewhere.
I was going to say, what's the view in London?
Yeah.
Kelowna for a long time had a rule that you had to be able to see the lake. Okay. That's really hard to do, that you can't obstruct somebody's view of the lake.
I don't know. Kelowna's very hilly.
Yeah, but you're looking down on a thing.
Yep. but, like, you know the Shard building in London?
Yeah.
That building is the shape that it is because that shard is clipped out because that is the view cone.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So it does create some architectural innovation. It does... it preserves people's views, and views are nice. I enjoy viewing them.
So as we approached the city council meeting, obviously there was a call for speakers and emails, and there were something like 150 emailed responses opposing breaking the view corridor, and I think one in support, if I remember the number correctly.
From Pavco?
Possibly. Maybe. And so this becomes an issue of, I think, whether or not, you know, the more housing people or the abundant housing types, sometimes they get this way. But the view cones don't actually restrict that much housing from being built to a large degree. And so I think you can get that housing somewhere else. But what became really key here is that Councillor Louis proposed an amendment at the 11th hour that was 700 words long that would allow Pavco to build a 400-foot building only if all of that building was rental.
It's weird that, like, CMHC's responsibilities are now being taken on by a provincial government entity that was, like, originally responsible for running convention centers.
Yes. And so now the Minister of Tourism, Lisa Baer, will have to decide whether or not to build a 400-foot rental building or a 300-foot condo. And the province will make less money if it's a rental building, presumably. Although, you know, the extra 100 feet is a bunch more units, and maybe you can amortize that out. I haven't looked at the numbers, but that's the thing. And so this debate almost was going to be a failure. Heather Deal said that she was prepared to vote no to any 400-foot building, but the idea that it could be all rental, she said, was something that they'd be willing to accept. The Vision line very quickly became 400 feet of rental, as their quote. And so Vision Vancouver voted in favor of allowing Pavco to do this if they so choose.
Well, and their lines got even more interesting as both Louis and then Gregor, to even a greater extent, tried to belittle almost the view cones that this absolutely was going to impinge upon.
And Gregor's really generally polite when he's chairing a meeting. Gregor is very polite and fair when he chairs meetings. It's something that, like, that Justin McElroy even tweeted that, you know, NPA counselors have admitted to Justin that, you know, Gregor is a very even-handed chair, and he got really snippy.
They both really started talking about trees on the specific view cones that were going to be impugned that are already blocking that view. And so they're lights. Are we going to knock down the trees and streetlights to protect your view? And it's like, those aren't the same thing.
No.
That's a false equivalency there, Mr.
And I think there's a lot of, one of you guys alluded to it earlier, but I think the audience is also pretty confused as to what exactly a view cone is and what exactly it means to have a, you know, like the height restriction of a building versus affecting the view cones. And you could see it all over the comments. Like, people were so confused about it. And I don't think, I don't know if the pictures help me understand it any better either. So I was like trying to be like, okay, this is what I think it is. And
well, and I saw people tweeting out the pictures of the, this is what the view cone will infringe
upon. With the yellow bars.
Yeah. But I saw them tweeting it out both in favor and against the product, like the same picture.
The war of pictures, I think was your word there, Ian, before we started recording, was that, like, there was a war of pictures on social media of, like, one person would post a picture and be like, look at how awful this is. And somebody else would post a picture that's almost identical and be like, look at how great this would be.
It doesn't do anything.
They're just, it's all in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Build the housing.
Yeah, and that became the latest controversy, and Vision's now positioning themselves as the 400 foot of rental, But notably, one pro-housing advocate on council did not vote.
Yeah, Hector Bremner decided he was in conflict of interest on this issue and recused himself from the entire debate. Well, NPA councillors Melissa Genova and George Affleck voted against the project, and Adrian Carr of the Greens voted against it.
Which, to be clear, is what he should have done.
Yeah, Raymond
is a good thing.
Raymond Louis indicated that at an earlier point in this situation that Bremner had not recused himself, but it's entirely possible that at an earlier point Hector had not had major news articles about him being a little sloppy with his recusements, and now he's being extra careful. And sure, extra careful.
Acting out of an abundance of caution very rarely leads to, like, you know, total calamity.
Mm-hmm.
But for reference, this would be roughly the same height as the TD Tower at 700 Georgia, which is above the... It's right next to Robson Square. Well,
but also, Matthew, bear in mind that this tower is going to go into the Northeast False Creek Flats. And so in terms of, like, absolute height above sea level,
Not what it was measuring
yeah. No, I know, but the 400 feet is going to be 400 feet up from the ground, isn't it? And so
that's what I was assuming.
Yeah, this is Northeast False Creek Flats, and so it's not actually all that high. That's why it's only really impinging on the one view cone.
Well, and the thing is, it's on, for people who are trying to figure out what we're talking about as we close this segment, this is on the east end of downtown, sort of past BC Place, going into where there's not a lot right now, and this is following the removal of the viaducts and rebuilding building a new neighborhood there, essentially, especially a lot of that empty land.
I love how this, like, this debate right now about what exactly is going to obstruct or not obstruct in the height, that's exactly what I was saying that you're seeing in the comments. It's like people can't figure out what this is all about. And I think, you know, whoever is making these decisions out there, you gotta communicate it more effectively, I think, if you really want people to understand.
Yeah.
I think the biggest problem, well, maybe one of the problems with the view cones is just like what Patrick was talking about, is they're kind of just arbitrarily chosen which ones we're
most
using.
Of them are not totally arbitrary. But. Like Heather Deal highlighted that they'd recently added a couple of years ago Chocolate Park, which is on the 7th Avenue bikeway on the West End. It's like by Ash. They'd recently added that as one of the view cone locations. And, you know, it's a very small park, but it's a really nice park. And people go and sit there and they look up at the skyline. And that, I think, is, you know, that's reasonable. Like, it seems to me like when I go to Dude Chilling Park with my friends, and I chill out there, like, as a dude, I look over at the mountains and stuff. Like, I like that. And I think that we can have housing without needing to destroy the view cones. I also don't think that this was a particularly egregious obstruction of the view cone, and I like rentals, so I don't know where I stand on this.
Depending on the architecture, I actually think that it might be a nice framing of...
Pavco's going to build it. It's going to look ugly.
What are you talking about? The convention center looks great.
Pavco didn't design that.
Pavco built it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can hire a good designer.
Yeah.
We have lovely architects.
For the record, Stantec is the architect that's been hired on for this.
Okay, well, that means nothing offhand to me, so why don't we move along to our next segment? Well, like a flock of birds shot from the sky, Brendan Yan has deleted a series of tweets as he begins his run for city council with one city. What does this...
Sorry, that was just so... That was nicely done. I enjoyed that.
He works very hard at these.
Yeah.
So, it's hard to tell what the actual story is here, because...
So, a bunch of guys from Halt discovered that they couldn't scroll past the 32nd 100th tweet in Brandon's Twitter feed and declared that he had deleted a whole host of his prior tweets.
Everything before January or something like that.
July
of last year?
Okay.
Yeah.
Of last year?
This year?
Oh, man,
this
he tweets year? A lot if that's the case.
He tweeted 3,200 times since July of last year.
To be fair, I think I did too.
Tweeting 10 times a day.
Some of them do.
Have you seen my Twitter feed?
No.
At Patmeister. So he did, he did delete a bunch of tweets, is my understanding. And they were older tweets, and a lot of them were, you know, tweets that he wasn't necessarily proud of, quick reaction tweets in anger, or as he described it, drunk tweets, oftentimes, which I can understand. And so this became a controversy for a bit, and a lot of news media came out to his defense, and I was really happy with that.
Well, I mean, what ranks as a Twitter controversy also seems to be a very low bar right now.
True.
Let me just say that it did not. I mean, I was fair enough. Okay, people can talk about whatever they want to talk about, but I don't know. Controversy felt like don't know if we'd quite hit that threshold.
Yeah.
Well, and it was interesting for me because up until now, I think One City has been in almost everyone's good books. Like, yep. Or no books. Like, you either didn't know about them, or if you did, you were like...
most people didn't know about them.
I kind of like... they have something nice to say about housing. They have something nice to say about gender equality and progressive social issues. No one was offended by them. But now, I think there's been this, like, effort to paint Brandon specifically as, like, a vision stooge or, like, vision light almost.
Because he was at one time a vision supporter, the HALT group, which HALT broadly speaking opposes density in the city and broadly speaking opposes
development. Everyone was a vision supporter at one point.
Well, and there's been memes about that. Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Vision Party? You know, stuff like that. And like, yeah,
I disagree with everyone who left Vision Vancouver after me.
Yeah, and so that's he's now being painted with this. But this Twitter controversy, I think, has such a youth aspect to it. You know, Brandon's, I think, 32 or 31. He might be 30. Younger guy, you know, in my mind, because he's younger than me by a year or two. and you know, it's. Every single election, we watch people under 35 get destroyed because of some idiot photo that's on their Facebook page from 12 years ago.
I don't think it's just younger politicians. I think, you know, it's like even older politicians who maybe don't realize how social media works or maybe how the internet works.
Racism is unacceptable.
That too. But like it really has felt like 21-year-old did something stupid, now 28-year-old is running for election. Why are we blaming 28-year-old for the mistake he made when he was 21?
I think the thing that's noticeable about this particular instance is that, you know, you see all kinds of politicians and candidates scrub things from their social media feeds that they feel might not be okay today when it might have been okay for them, as you say, you know, like a 22-year-old. Drunk teen. But the fact that he had removed his entire history, not just a few select ones, I think is what was different about this particular situation. And I think that's what made it remarkable and noticeable.
I mean, it's not entirely unknown or unheard of for that to have happened. I know Bowen Ma completely obliterated all her social media accounts before running in what she called a very painful decision.
Yeah, and that's a really tough one because there's really great memories. I had that thought because I went through my Twitter history and I realized I've been on Twitter for 8 years. You know, I was 24 and I was going and live tweeting Canucks games with a lot of swear words during like the 2011 Stanley Cup run and the 2010 loss to the Chicago Blackhawks and the 2009 loss to the Chicago Blackhawks. And like, I was oftentimes fairly intoxicated during those periods, and I don't want those tweets to be, like, used as an example of my character if I ever, which I won't, but if I ever run for public office.
I really don't want people to know about the grammatical mistakes that I let slide, you know, well, years ago.
And there's a prioritization issue, like, to go through decades of, you know, up to a decade, essentially, Twitter's a decade old, of tweets and go keep, delete, takes a long time.
Sure.
And reasonably, Brandon's got more important things to do, like his job, because he's still working, like most candidates at this point, and campaigning his ass off. So,
well, Brandon,
just hitting the delete all button.
In all honesty, I did terrible. I did it this week. I went and I made the conscious decision that 1 month after the transit referendum ended would be the point that everything before that would be deleted. And I just did that. So, you know, my tweet history only goes back 3 years now.
I mean, I'm not saying that that might have been the way he was thinking about it, but I think if you do it in such an obvious way, then fair or not, somebody is going to remark on it. And I think you just have to be prepared to defend your position on it. That's all. I mean, to not have a plan of action and not to think that somebody won't notice that. I would say that you need to have something in mind, like you need to have a strategy in mind for how you're going to address that.
So not only does Brandon have better things to do, for example, the One City campaign, so do we. For example, the One City campaign, their windfall proposal has been recently dropped, a white paper-ish thing. I don't know, maybe not.
It's an election platform plank.
Yeah, and this
but
is...
But it reeks of like white paperiness. Yeah, it's very technical.
This is a policy piece that's been floating around the vine of Vancouver politics, Vancouver real estate politics for a number of years now. This land value capture or land lift capture, or there's a whole host of ways to call it. And basically, the idea is if I buy a house for $10 tomorrow and I sell it next week for $20, the city, the province, or the city, or somebody, some level of government will claw back a dollar of that. The win. So, you know, I've just gained $10. They'll take 10% of that. That's a dollar. Who knows what the percentage would be, whether it would be 1, 2, 3, 10%. But the idea that, you know, if it, and this only primarily happens with primary homes, because your secondary home, or like a secondary home, the thing you buy and rent out, also gets capital gains taxes on value gain when you sell it. But if I buy a house and I live in it for 20 years, like, you know, a lot of baby boomers did, and I bought it for $80,000 in Kitsilano in 1976, and I sell it for $3.8 million in 2018, some amount of that could... The idea that none of that would go and get clawed back through any kind of taxation measure is so weird to me.
Well, we do have the property transfer tax, but that's...
Doesn't apply a smaller to first homes.
Nor does it apply to the value land lift. And so the idea is, if I, in 1976, when I was negative 9 years old, let's say I had bought a bunch of stock in Apple, and I also bought a home in Kitsilano, the time now when I divest those two things would be, when I sell those Apple stocks, there's capital gains on the percentage of the gain that I've made. But if I'd lived in that house from the time when I was -9 to now when I'm 33, I would not get taxed on the value add of the $3 or $4 or $5 million I would have now made in profits in real dollars adjusted for inflation.
But would you have made more money off Apple or Kitsilano housing?
I mean, most assuredly Apple, but it's not actually it probably is not, right? A clear cut.
It's not that clear cut.
I mean, it's the most valuable company in the world, so...
More than likely, especially through dividends.
That you've raised an interesting point there, because, like, at least emotionally, it seems like the income that and the increased value that you have generated through your Apple stock purchase, which was like concretely an investment, you were buying stock.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't living in that stock.
Yeah, you weren't living in the stock. If I could live in the, if I was living in the stock, then I would like. Get a couple of those financial instruments that are as roommates, and then move into a place in Cole Harbour. Everything makes sense, what I just said. Everything makes as much sense as the Vancouver real estate market.
I mean, that's probably true.
But this idea is really popular with people like Tom Davidoff, who's a very outspoken academic at UBC.
BC Government Employees Union has also been in favor of this kind of an action for some time.
Has it ever been tried elsewhere? We'll get back to you.
Anybody have a cricket noise on their phone?
Well, at some point, we're probably going to talk to Tom Davidoff, and we will ask him that directly.
The other thing is that this money would go into building housing. And so one of the things they said was that if this had been installed like 10 years ago at 1% rate, it would have raised $15 billion for the government coffers for housing. That if it was dedicated to housing, so the government would have built $15 billion worth of social housing, would have probably bought all of the Sahota properties up and refurbished them, would have... I don't know what you do with the other $10 billion after you spent $5 billion on all the social housing.
Well, I think one city's even talking that it's not just necessarily that it has to go to social housing, but they could also, you know, start building like childcare or other service programs.
Oh,
or
better parks. If we had had a 1% land value capture instituted in like 2008, that $15 billion is a lot of money.
Now, of course, that number also assumes that market forces wouldn't have changed in response to it.
Yeah, but I mean, a 1% catch on the land lift alone is seems to be pretty minimal. Like, you still get 99% of the benefit.
Well, I think we can turn away from the windfall proposal to a Vancouverada, a segment where we look at an interesting part of Vancouver's past. And today we are looking at flood mitigation protests in Richmond. Oh, no. No, something else.
Oh, I see what you're doing.
Yeah, he's making a joke on
you're making a joke.
Homonyms.
Yeah.
So, this is Pride Week here in Vancouver because, well, the rest of the world dedicates June to be Pride Month. The weather here is hit and miss in June, but it's always great this week, as we've learned. Too great, as we're sweating here. But... part of
I'm
Pride
literally
Week.
A glossy version of myself.
Part of it's Pride Week here in Vancouver is the Pride Parade that everyone knows, goes to, 500,000 people always attend on the Sunday of August long weekend. But the day before that, so this Saturday, is the annual Dyke March. And this is the lesbian pride march, essentially. It was kind of a spin-off challenge and kind of a way to say pride, especially in the early days, was very white gay men who should be speaking up and should have, and it was valuable that they're speaking up, but many lesbians felt...
No one needs to tell us to speak up, though.
But many lesbians at the time were felt not paid enough attention
I think the best way to put it is, and I was going through some historical documents about a student union that was fighting for a queer space, what we now would call a queer space on campus, like a safe space on campus for the people of the queer community. And every letter to the university called for a GLBT space. And that's so alien to me because I've only ever heard it as LGBTQ and then, you know, what, depending on what year it is, how many things that we had after that as we get more inclusionary. But it's so interesting that, you know, it was GLBT for so long. And then eventually there was this conscious take back to make it a more inclusive space and not a space dominated by one element of those four letters.
Also, GEL is such a gross, like, thing in my mouth, like, as opposed to LG.
I think the like sound of it also changes.
The flow of it works better. But like, irrespective of that, the Dyke March was always meant to be a somewhat subversive and counter protest to the broader Pride, you know, parade, which originally was a very white male dominated thing and has become dominated by banks.
Yeah, but the first Dyke March, because these happen around the world now, but the first one was actually here in Vancouver. And there's some contention about this because they didn't call them Dyke Marches at the time. They were just like lesbian protests around Pride. The first one was, though, as far as we can tell, was here in Vancouver in May 1981 in downtown. There was this bi-national lesbian conference. And I think bi-national means every other year, or maybe it means something else.
Or I think it means two nations.
Two nations. There you go.
Yeah, as opposed
to Canada and the U.S. Something else. But in, May 1981, the lesbians held their march as a way. You had about 200 people actually show up. And since then, it's become kind of the counter-cultural protest where Pride, like you say, attracts TD Bank and Scotiabank and all the big corporate sponsors. Mm-hmm. And it's this massive 3-4 hour event as it grows and grows. I'll be marching with my nonprofit on Sunday with it. And we are in the H section of the I-th section. So there's now like 7 parts to go out. Yeah. It's going to be obnoxiously long and hot.
Well, I will be doing what I do for every Pride week for the last couple of years. And that is getting out of Vancouver.
So I went to a Dyke March about 2 or 3 years ago. Some friends of mine were on the board at the time. And I think one of them still is. And, you know, it was really neat. I helped sort of do, because, you know, they were friends of mine. I helped them tear down and sort of pack up and stuff. But the thing for me was Granby Woodlands, that Commercial Drive neighborhood, used to be a real sort of hub of the lesbian community of Vancouver. And even until when I was like 18, 19, 20, it really still was. And, you know, the drive has really changed in its dynamic in the last 20 years or 12 years. Sorry, I'm not that old. So in the last like dozen years, the drive has really changed in its dynamic. And so the day that I went out there for the Dyke March, it really felt in the demographics and the people and the style like it was the drive that I remember when I was a kid going to the drive. And, you know, it was really fascinating to see that throwback as everybody came out for this.
And so if you want to be part of the Dyke March, check out their website. We'll put a link in the description. I think it's vancouverdykemarch.com, but I did not write that down.
And remember to practice good allyship, especially you, white gay men. We are bad at that sometimes.
And the march is Saturday, August 4th at 11th, ending at Grandview Park. There'll be a big festival there as well with tents.
Yeah, so it starts at McSpadden Park at 11 a.m. Some pre-march festivities and a community art project. Then the march will leave McSpadden Park at 12 p.m. noon and make their way to Commercial Drive to end at Grandview Park for the festival. And the festival is really fascinating. Even if you can't be there for the march itself, the festival has tents and all sorts of interesting things there to see and be part of and just show support.
And it's part of Vancouver's history.
Yeah.
Well, 4 score and 3 days to go.
Did you Google that in the last hour of our podcast?
No.
You just know what 4 score means.
Oh, yeah. Matthew Wood.
Anyway, Lincolnalia aside, remind everyone what the URL for your newsletter is so they can sign up.
Yes, it is cbc.ca/metromatters.
That's cbc.ca/metromatters.
Do you have anything else you wanted to plug? while you're here? Maybe your Twitter handle or...
Sure. I mean, if people want to tweet me their questions that they have about the upcoming municipal election or anything that they would like us to cover, you know, or want to know more directly from the candidates, so the parties themselves, you can tweet me. My Twitter handle is twitter.com/Tamara_Beluja. And you can also tweet Justin McElroy. I don't have his Twitter handle memorized, but...
He is at @JMcElroy.
J. McElroy.
Not to be confused with the gamer Justin McElroy, who has at Justin McElroy.
It's J underscore McElroy, though, isn't it?
Is it?
I think it's underscore, yeah. Anyway, you can tweet either one of us and we will do our best to get your questions answered.
Also, please give us 5-star reviews on iTunes and lots of money at Patreon, please.
I will say we've got our Slack channel up and running for our Patreon subscribers, and it's been really fascinating this week. We've had some really interesting comments come out of it. People are sharing news articles, and it's becoming a really fun community for me to jump in and chat with people on.
So patreon.com/CanbyReport. You can also follow us at CanbyReport on Twitter and Facebook. I think the other reason to join our Patreon is we'll probably announce our next live show there first and give those people first access for early tickets. We had a great turnout last week.
Yeah.
No, Thursday. Yeah,
oh, man. It seems like a million years ago for some reason.
It was a little bit more than a week ago.
It was
ago,
a week and
actually.
A half ago.
Yeah.
It was 10 days ago.
Yeah. But we had, you know, 55, 60 people at the Belmont, which was fantastic.
A number
we'll
of
probably
candidates.
Be there again.
Yeah, a number of candidates for council came out, which was really neat, as well as some other interesting people. And yeah, really fun activity. It's just fun to see our listeners come out and get a chance to sort of meet them face to face.
83 days to go. We can do this. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
Good night.
I was going to say, and thank you for coming on the podcast.